Everyone's back. We're going to continue on. Now we're probably going to get ready to listen to how it's, this is all going to shape our communities on into the future. Our shifts in how we live, how we learn, our lifestyles, everything is impacted by COVID. This is the big topic today. Technology, social, our cultural, our future infrastructure environment, share future insights on what the future might look like and feel like. We're pleased to announce on camera here, Simon O'Byrne. He's the EVP of Stantec, Edmonton, and perspectives on the arrival of the Jetson family citizenry. Future communities to live, work, play. Jetsons, we always think that we're going to be living in the Jetson mode. It hasn't happened yet, but it's getting faster and closer. Simon O'Byrne is both an award-winning urban designer, planner, and senior vice president of Stantec's global community development business. As a city building expert, he's been frequently quoted in European and North American media and has done many keynote talks on both continents. Simon is very active, I almost said attractive, in the community and has chaired many as an organization such as the Edmonton Chamber of Commerce, Downtown Vibrancy Task Force, Habitat for Humanity, National Leadership Council, Winter Cities, and the Center to All Sexual Exploitation. He's been named as one of Edmonton's Power 30 by the Edmonton Journal, one of the most 50 influential Albertans by Alberta Venture, and was in Avenue Magazine's first top 40 under 40 list. He's probably 42 now. Simon, welcome. I hand it off to you.
Thank you very much, Brent. Late 40s now, so time's gone marching on. So thank you, everyone. I'm going to share my screen here. If you could let me know, folks could let me know if they could see it okay. And then if I can get a thumbs up, perfect, you can see it okay, perfect. I'm just gonna go to full screen mode and hopefully everyone's still seeing it. Perfect. So I wanna talk a little bit about communities and how communities are evolving. Where they're, to use the Gretzky analogy, a little bit about where the puck is going as opposed to where it is today in cities and city building, and also how it relates then also to employment and kind of getting future-proofed in terms of the job market and the different respective opportunities that are out there. So I want to start off by talking a little bit about VUCA as context, some urban innovations and best practices that we see. And we're talking a lot about technology today, and I'm going to talk about smart cities and give you some examples of ones that are on the shelf today or ones that are in the very near future in some of these things that are kind of emerging. So people that are in the design space like Stantec and other organizations, that some of these things are very much front of mind. But for all of us that are kind of that are in cities, functioning in cities, there's a lot of things that are about to change. And I'm going to highlight a couple of them. It's not an exhaustive list, but really hopefully a decent survey of some of them. So VUCA, for those who don't know, stands for volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity. The term started with the U.S. military just to convey what's going on in terms of society and living in a VUCA age. Right now, what really kind of constitutes a break of VUCA age is obviously what's happening in COVID-19. There's been trade wars in a way that we had a very liberalized economy for a long time, and we didn't have as many kind of trade rifts that we have today. We see Brexit happening. We see the battle on trade that happened between China and the United States, increasing political risk in terms of populism from both the far left and far right rising. We see a lot more kind of increased polarization in society, more nationalism, and another big political unstabilizing entity is the degree of inequality. And we just saw a stat that came out a little while ago that I think the stat was 464 Americans own as much wealth as 50% of Americans. So 464 people are as wealthy as half of the United States. That type of inequality is destabilizing, as is the environmental change that's going on and what that type of environmental change means for society. And I want to, in this presentation, talk about what are some of the things we can do to prepare for that And obviously this day is focused a lot on some of the technological changes that are occurring. In just a moment, I'll talk about some of the demographic shifts that we're seeing, because they're very much impacting design and communities as well. We're also seeing very much a rise of, you know, the petrostate versus the electrostates. But China, Europe, California are all talking about banning sales of the internal combustion engine by the 2030s. We've seen huge progress made in batteries, with more to come. Tesla's talking about being able to sell another version of an EV that would be $25,000 within 2 to 3 years' time. So as EVs get progressively cheaper, and as internal combustion engines get banned in some places, and we see a focus on renewables in some jurisdictions, we're going to have a lot of challenges between those are petrostates versus electrostates. What happens? We've also seen with COVID a supply chain disruption and panic buying that happens, that I think that some of us in the West and places like Canada were not used to. We just took it for granted that if we went to the store, that everything we'd ever want would be there and be there immediate. We now live in the Amazon age where if you have Prime, you're expecting it almost same day delivery. We saw those supply chains get disrupted, and things that were once accessible are harder to get a hold of and having to wait a long period, whether it's, you know, trying to get a bike or it's even kind of the toilet paper rush that happened in the springtime. The other kind of phenomena is obviously kind of is the VUCA age, and what does it mean to be working from home? How much does that continue forward? What does that mean to downtowns and the office workforce? We've also touched base on that, as well as, you know, changes that have happened in terms of the level of consumer and government debt. There's been an unparalleled level of quantitative easing. So quantitative easing, for those that aren't that familiar with it, is effectively printing money. And you can do it, provided that inflation doesn't spike, that there's enough buyers out there of your of the debt that you're issuing. But T-bills in the U.S. and our own government's ability to raise money in the bond market has been remarkable. I think better than most people would have expected. But I'll touch base in a moment why some of that's occurring. But nevertheless, governments and consumers have taken on unbelievable amounts of debts. The housing market is spiking across Canada and in many countries right now, fueled by unbelievably low interest rates. You can now have if you have a floating interest rate on your mortgage, it's now starting with a one. That is just unfathomable to prior generations, but the result is people taking on crazy amounts of debts in order to purchase things. And obviously the other kind of big disruption coming is the scale of climate refugees. So Europe was scary when there was a couple hundred thousand refugees coming from other parts of the world. It'll be in the tens of millions in the coming decades in light of what rising temperatures will do to food insecurity and the devastation of crops, not to mention flooding and heat and so forth. So, but particularly driven by extreme collapse of food production. So we're going to see climate refugees on a scale that is unimaginable today. But these are some of the things that are going to disrupt how we're at. The other thing that's disrupting is that we have an antiquated narrative about the Canadian economy. There's actually far more tech jobs in Canada than there are jobs in natural resources. And it's something that doesn't get talked about enough in Canada in this context of jobs and employment. I think that too much of the oxygen is focused on natural resources. It's still a very important part of our economy. But we're adding jobs on the tech side far faster than people appreciate we are. And it's an important part of the story, as is, you know, it's been talked about a lot today, so I'm not going to belabor it. But working from home is changing, and not just working from home, but working from different locations. So you don't have to live in an expensive location anymore. You can work elsewhere. I was talking to someone the other day in New York City just yesterday, and their colleague moved from the Upper West Side to Northern Arkansas of all places, and was doing their job in New York City now from Arkansas. And they're, you know, for the price of their small apartment on the Upper West Side, they're able to buy beautiful acreage in Arkansas. That type of phenomena is going on. The question is, how will it continue in perpetuity? And if so, by what measure? Other things are changing is the degree of change that 5G permits and transparency in clouds. The other things that are kind of changing in terms of disruption are really around, like you said, the interest rates. Part of things that's also been driving down interest rates is that there's simply too much capital in the world. It sounds kind of weird to say, but there's an absolutely extraordinary amount of capital out there right now. Sovereign wealth funds are gigantic. The one for example, Norway is, Norway now owns something like 5% of the world's stock that is traded and publicly. They're huge. And Canada actually has some of the biggest sovereign wealth funds in the world as well. So we've seen huge amount of money that's out there coming from private equity, insurance companies, asset management companies, and there's a ton of capital right now, and part of it's simply demographics. The baby boomers globally have accumulated a huge amount of wealth, and they're looking for returns on investment, and simply the interest rates aren't that high, so they're putting their money into wherever they can get some semblance of a return that's better than inflation, and the tsunami of all their pension funds, all the different aggregate investments, is that there's trillions of dollars that are out there right now. And that's part of the reason that we're seeing, and we will, I think, for quite a long period of time, continue to see very low interest rates. The other thing that we kind of see that's going to continue on is, despite every single government that seems to come in and talk about cutting red tape, the reality is it never really gets cut. The tax code only gets bigger every decade. And it never gets a reset. You never throw in the garbage and redo it. It's simply just governments that come into power always add new regulations and policies, but they never spend the time doing the subtraction. It's always the addition and never subtraction. I remember I started my career more than 20 years ago working with local government, and the development industry complained 20 something years ago about how awful and laborious the process was for approvals. Well, now the developers of that time would just be shocked and would just kind of spin, their heads would spin if they realized what the process was today and the regulatory requirements. My point is that these things continue to go on a trajectory. And as somebody who works globally, I can tell you that even though we think we have a red tape, it's still a lot less here than it is in many jurisdictions. It doesn't mean that it's a good thing, but I'm just saying that these are some of the kind of changes that are occurring, as is their focus on sustainability and affordability being critical. Carbon taxes are critical. Funny enough, people don't appreciate that carbon taxes is actually a conservative idea. I was talking to Ernest Manning about this a couple months ago at lunch, and he kind of was pointing out how he really felt that the conservatives should own the idea of a carbon tax, and that they originated it and should own the environmental file, and it let it slip away. But regardless of whether or not it's a conservative or left-wing or centrist idea, it's coming, and it's some version of it is coming in light of the changes that are happening. The other thing we have to think about in terms of the generational shift and how it's going to impact cities and how we live and how we live, work, play, and study is the dependency ratio. Right now, we have over 4.5 people paying taxes for every one dependent. In the 80s, it was 7-1. And by the 2030s, it's only going to be 3-1. There'll only be 3 people paying taxes for every one person needing taxes. That's because of the young population and the quantity of people north of 65. So that means that we're going to have a reckoning in terms of, we're not going to simply have the volume of tax revenue needed to support the services that I think people expect to have, and the infrastructure and the military and the post office and everything else. So there has to be some type of reckoning. So these are some of the things that are going to change the future. The other kind of things in our blockchain, and obviously the Internet of Things that I think people are very familiar with, and AI and AGI. And I think some people don't, and I think I'll touch on really quickly today, but some people don't necessarily appreciate the difference between AI and AGI. So AI is effectively designing machine learning to work within a box, and you build the box and you define the edges of the box. AGI is behavior-based learning. So it's effectively, it's like a quantum leap over AI. So I think people kind of confuse the two, but AI is still a couple decades away, where it's basically machine learning that that isn't within a box. And so it has its capacity for AGI's capacity for machine learning is on an unbelievable scale. But there's a big important distinction. The other thing that I'm going to talk about that's kind of in the near future is connected and shared autonomous vehicles. There's too much focus on autonomous vehicles, and really what is much more important is what's happening in the space of connected autonomous vehicles. There won't be just autonomous vehicles. There's autonomous vehicles, but they need to speak to one another, and they need to speak to the infrastructure. So the intersections are, the infrastructure is talking to the cars and letting them know what's happening 50 miles down the road, what's happening in the area, how many pedestrians are in the area, how many cyclists are in the area, and their where is the black ice, where are the potholes, and sharing all that data. And infrastructure like 5G enables that. The other thing that we've seen that's really been a game changer in the design space is parametric design. We can now design bridges in 5 minutes. So bridges that might have taken months to draw in terms of construction documentation, we can literally do in 5 minutes now in with parametric design. So we talk about, some of the speakers today have talked about how the labor force is really kind of changed. Well, it has changed, and one of the areas is literally going from months of design to design a bridge to now needing 5 minutes to come up with 80% of the construction drawings. That's how sophisticated the AI-related parametric design is, and that's tools like that that we're companies like Stantec employing regularly. And then the other kind of disruption is things like what Sidewalk Collapse is considering, and I'm going to get into that in just a moment. The other things that they're really impacting how we're live, work, playing, and studying are things like age cohorts, the pending labor shortages. COVID's obviously hijacked that for a temporary period of time, but then we're going to go back to on the other side of COVID. We still have a phenomenal amount of baby boomers exiting and retiring, and there's not enough people coming in behind them. In fact, in the near future, if we didn't have a substantial immigration, we'd have more deaths in Canada than births. So we need to have robust immigration. We need to have at least 1% of the population immigrate to Canada every year, and we need to make it much more affordable. And the other thing that's going to change in, as it relates to cities and cities building is, versus 100 years ago, the people that are driving immigration today, and you can see the stats and what countries they're coming from, predominantly come from countries where multifamily housing is the norm, not the exception, where three generations are living together, where there's two kitchens in some communities, where there can be a regular kitchen and there's a spice kitchen with different ventilation. That is the norm, and that is increasingly becoming the norm in new developments in Edmonton, and whether it's our suburbs or elsewhere. I think people would be surprised with the quantity of multifamily housing in Canada and how it's one of the fastest growing typologies in Canada. The other thing is just migration and how that's changing, and rental. We're gonna see a huge amount of rental housing built. I think that COVID has really taken a lot of trends that are out there and really kind of exacerbate them. There's a huge gulf right now between the have and have nots. The haves that already have money are rushing to get into housing, which is why we're seeing prices skyrocket in some cases. But we're also seeing a huge quantity of people that don't have the means, and they're gonna be in rental housing. And there's a lot of people driven there by, because they're simply sinks and dinks, so single income, double income, no kids, and also driven by things like divorce, and divorce is a big driver of kind of the rental market as well. So all these things are leading to mass disruption in kind of the book age. So, okay, so knowing all that, so what do we do about it? What are some of the innovations or best practices that we should be thinking of and should be front of mind? So some of them is simply repurposing what we used to do, that we can't. We're going to continue to have some suburban development, but we also have to be much more innovative and creative of reuse and adaptation of things that have been built in the past. So there's projects like Granary Square and King's Cross. For those who are familiar with London, this is actually a Stantec project where redevelopment of what was at one time a Victorian era coal yards. And it's basically the main train terminal area that gets you to the north of England. And we've been involved in kind of the transformation of this huge area of London. These type of brownfield developments are going to become the norm. because we don't have in a lot of our cities now the space needed for the quantity of people that are coming. So we have to reimagine these spaces, and we have to make them different for the future. So that's going to be a big trend we're going to see a lot more of. Another big trend is resiliency. And I talked about climate change and climate refugees, but one of the things we have to do is adapt cities so that they can be much more resilient. Philadelphia had a choice. They could either spend $6 billion on burying a huge stormwater pipe to make the city more resilient, because every time it was flooding, not every time, but every kind of significant storm event, the older parts of Philadelphia had a combined sanitary storm system. So when it flooded, you'd have all the sewage would overflow as well, not just the stormwater. And so they had to build a huge storm line that would be able to take that all away. But somebody came up with the idea and said, well, what happens if we were to green Philadelphia as opposed to burying it all in a pipe? Could we achieve the same outcome? And they model it, and they could find that they could actually decrease they could actually have the same outcome simply by greening Philadelphia. So rather than burying this huge pipe in the ground that was enormous, they decided to model it, and they could green Philadelphia and do these thousands of micro interventions. So they took asphalt and concrete and converted it to green space with rain gardens and soil cells, and make them add boulevards where there weren't boulevards, and make them deep so that the trees could grow, in fact, twice as fast because they had a lot more water access and better quality soil, and they'd have more evaporation, more absorption, and it made the cities a lot more resilient. And these type of things are a huge difference. This is the thing that we're going to see in all kinds of different cities in order to increase resiliency. We've done this in London, Ontario, and in many other places, is these kind of micro interventions that the cumulative effects of doing thousands of these are that we can make our cities more resilient to climate change so that things aren't as bad. And people, you know, I don't know if people realize that, but it's really bad in some places, and it's happening in North America in a big way. In three of the last 4 years, Houston has had 3 1 in 500 year events in 4 years. In fact, one of them was arguably a 1 in 800 year event. So 3 1 in 500 year events in 4 years. We're in a whole new normal, and the engineering and the kind of scientific paradigms that we've drafted up in the past have to go in the rubbish bin, and we have to completely rethink cities because frost is going deeper than it used to when we're having extreme events. We're getting way more water than we used to. And when it comes, it's much bigger. It's much bigger and more damaging than it was in the past. Cities like Rotterdam are reinventing. This is their version of Churchill Square, where they have to make it versatile. So you can't just say, well, we're going to have a public space and a public park but rather it has to do multiple purposes. We have to store water on rooftops. We have to have it so that squares can be flooded once a year or once every 2 years. They have to be versatile, and we need spaces to be able to do multiple things, be a public gathering space, but also be places where we can have stormwater gathered. We also have to reuse our space differently. So Melbourne and Victoria, British Columbia, and other cities have really converted a lot of their alleys now towards great corridors, corridors that connect, that created business opportunities for local businesses. And this is really important for us to consider in place like Edmonton, where in winter city design, we want to make it comfortable for people to be outside. And so we need to redevelop our alleys so that they can become corridors for people to get from A to B, because they're protected by the wind. And that's the biggest thing with winter city design, is getting away from the wind. Cities are also changing, and Paris is one of the first cities to do this, but now everyone's hopping on the bandwagon, which is really about how do we redesign our city so that you can live, work, play, and study within a 15 minutes of one another. The public health data shows that if you walk 10 to 15,000 steps a day, your chance of diabetes and heart and stroke go down by 95%. And the biggest killer in North America from a public health perspective is heart and stroke. So if you can design our cities so we're not as car dependent, we can walk more, and it's simply just our natural life cycle, because we've built these urban villages where we can work, live, play, and study in closer proximity. And so we're walking more, and we're more active, and we're getting 10 to 15,000 steps. we can have a huge difference in terms of public health, in terms of reducing diabetes and heart and stroke. So the impact on changing how we design cities is huge for public health, what that means for public dollars, what that means for quality of life. And we don't have to segregate our land uses like we did for so very long. Likewise, we saw this trend emerge with COVID. It already existed before, but now it's been supercharged with COVID, which is parklets. So taking the land that was previously put aside for parking and turning that into places for the public realm and for restaurateurs and so forth. These trends have to continue. We have to make your streets better. We have to make them more interesting, delightful. And we have to allow restaurants, especially during winter, to be able to kind of reclaim these spaces so that people can go outside. And we have to create more sticky spaces in our streets. We have to convert more streets, not every street, but we have to pick some winners and losers. And we have to say, what are the streets that we really want to be successful? Our downtowns are really dying right now, and they're in a real horrible way because of COVID. We need to create a couple clusters. We use food. Food is the secret sauce to make our cities successful. But you can't do it everywhere. You can't just say, oh, we're going to make every street in the downtown successful. Instead, you have to pick a couple of winners and losers. You have to say, we're going to urbanize these areas and focus on pedestrianizing them. We're going to make them a restaurant cluster. We're going to provide a ton of temporary tables and chairs to allow these patios to go out there and have a bring your own blanket culture in winter cities. And if we don't do that, a lot of our restaurants won't survive to the other side, and our downtowns are not going to be on a great trajectory. Denver and others have been doing that as well. So shrinking the size of roadways and saying, do they really need to be that big? So too many of our roadways have been designed to just move the max amount of people for just the peak rush hour, which is just 1 hour a day for 5 days a week. So are you designing the street for 5 hours in a 24/7 period, or do you want to design it for every day? Those are the type of things we have to reconsider. One of the case studies that we tend to know a little bit better, at least at Stantec, is Sidewalk Labs took over Quayside. And even though they've kind of walked away from the project more recently, others are stepping in and are going to carry forward some of the ideas. And right now it's an RFP to redevelop it. But have a lot of the good ideas from it go forward. And Sidewalk Labs is on the east side of Toronto. It's 200 plus year old land that was part of the Portlands east of downtown Toronto. So it's a redevelopment of it. And it's an area that, you know, is the Gardner to the north of it, but it's very close to it. And there's the extension that will come when this land develops, the Cherry Street car will be extended to this land to kind of plug it into the streetcar network of Toronto. So it's an area that you can see is kind of blighted. It's not reached its fullest and greatest potential. And what we wanted to do is kind of redesign this area so that we focus on quality of life. Urban Places Group led a lot of it. Nancy McDonald, who was a speaker earlier today, was one of the co-project managers on this. And it was looking at how to redevelop this area with a focus on quality of life, sustainability, and future-proofing it, and making an area that was actually going to be adaptable and flexible for different uses. And look at the different layers of it, from the infrastructure to the public realm, mobility, rethinking mobility, the built form that was going to be used, and the digital layer, and creating digital twins of it so it could learn from one another. And redevelop it, this area, so that it could have thousands of people living in it, thousands of jobs, and be done entirely different than what it was before. So some of the ideas, for example, were entirely built out of wood, so not concrete and steel, so much more sustainable building product using Canadian wood that is sustainable. It allows for carbon capture effectively by reusing the wood, reusing the stormwater that's in the area for gray water and black water, and not planning it for cars, but transit and walking and cycling and scooters and autonomous vehicles, but basically making it ready for autonomous vehicles from day one, and also having a freight delivery system so that when you have Amazon delivery and other deliveries, they go to a centralized area, they gather up all the boxes, and there's an underground freight system that delivers all the parcels, whether it's groceries or your Amazon delivery, to the building. And developing a whole freight system for the area. So these were kind of some of the things that were done that are really on the merging edge that are going to be coming into the future here. If you kind of Google Sidewalk Labs, you can find out a lot more about it, but I just want to kind of start to speed up here. Other projects closer to home here are Active Aurora. This is one of our projects that we've been involved with here in Edmonton, which is about creating Canada's first test track for autonomous vehicles that allows car-to-car and car-to-infrastructure communication. This is really critical to this type of research is critical to facilitating a future towards autonomous vehicles. We've also had some projects now built where we are running autonomous vehicle shuttle buses that don't have a driver. They don't have, they don't even have a steering wheel, and they can move 10 to 12 people at a time. So Chambly is in the Atlanta area. Actually, this area is immediately next to the Center for Disease Control. It's a very built up area with a lot of traffic. So it was done as a way to kind of, you can put a lot more vehicles on the road. So to look at autonomous vehicles instead. So the next thing I'm going to show you here is a quick video that shows you how we're now designing highways so that it starts with HOV lanes. So HOV lanes get converted to autonomous vehicle lanes and then increasingly get bigger. And then you can see how much more traffic can become efficient as it kind of evolves. So I'm going to, you know what? I can't do the video because I put this in PDF, not the PowerPoint, but I'll have to share that at a different time. Some of the other things, but all it basically shows is the efficiency of autonomous vehicles and how it works. And a lot of it's being driven by the insurance industry. 95% of all accidents in North America happen because of human error. So autonomous vehicles basically models that out. We have a couple thousand people a year in Canada that die from automobile accidents, tens of thousands in the US. So imagine being able to end 95% of that simply by having autonomous vehicles. The other things that's already happening is automated valet parking. Tesla's had this already for 2 or 3 years. Where you go to the parking garage, bring up your phone and have the car drive up to you. So it's ready. And now it's going mainstream. Ford launched it already. So Ford now has this technology as well. And it will be long within 2 or 3 years that every single car company has this. Well, once this happens, parking garages can be 30 to 40% more efficient than they are right now. And you'll never park a car in a garage again. You'll simply just have the app and it'll drive up your car for you. Likewise, we're going to see a lot more conversion. At some point, we're going to start to see gas stations being converted towards charging stations. They're going to become people places where there's a place to get coffee or a burger or something. The gas stations and things like that are going to start to be converted towards this. We're seeing this in Europe in a big way, and eventually it'll follow to North America. The other thing we've also seen is a focus on renewable energies. One of the biggest trends in places where there is a bigger focus on EVs is where to get all the energy from, how do you store it, how do you distribute it. And so we've been doing a lot of work in Europe on this, which is a lot further down this road than we are today. That's something that's emerging right now. Same thing with smart buildings. The smart buildings is really about data collection, having sensors and everything. So you can model how people are using this space and using water and where they're going and where they're not going. And using that data so we can have smarter buildings and smarter use of spaces. And then really focusing on data management and the collection of it and realizing that there's a huge amount of money that can be had from owning that data. And just kind of wrapping up here and just to conclude, because I've been a little longer than I wanted to be, it's just a focus here on creativity, that a lot of the job skills that we're going to need really are focused on finding people that want to be creative, that are innovative, that want to play that next octave on the piano and want to think strange. And the type of people that we're looking for at Stantec are those type of people that think strange, that want to be part of this new type of city building that's happening today, and is only going to accelerate a little bit faster in the future. So thank you.
Wow. Simon, I don't know if I know where to begin, because I can't remember. You gave us so much information, I don't remember where we started. There was a lot of information in a PowerPoint presentation. I know Eva wants us to go to a transpod conversation, but I think I have a couple other questions prior to that I think that you can add clarity to. I think the biggest one that I have right now is how is Alberta doing in terms of transition into smart cities and adopting new technologies? How's the Edmonton region doing, and what's our potential?
So one of the ones we are doing well on is getting ready for autonomous vehicles. So the Project Aurora that I talked about is a partnership between the three levels of government, including St. Albert and the University of Alberta. Stantec's a part of it as well. And so we've got some of the top scientists in the world working on this. In fact, the national minister for transportation from China flew here. It wasn't a big ceremony because they kind of wanted to be a little bit under the radar. We actually had the head of China's equivalent of transportation minister come here to model and look at what we're doing with a whole bunch of their Chinese experts. We're doing a lot of really good things. There's some smart intersections we already have in place at Anthony Hendy Drive, White Mud, 23rd Avenue and 119th Street. So it knows how many vehicles are coming towards it. We put sensors in buses, so it can change accordingly based on knowing that a bus is coming. So if the priority is for the bus, it'll change the intersection and the lights accordingly. So in real time, so as opposed to, you know, a traffic engineer programming it months or a year in advance with all kinds of presumptions, it's changing in real time with real sensors and LIDAR and reading how many pedestrians there are, how much public transit there is, how many vehicles there are, how well it's flowing. So it's doing it very organically based on what's actually there. So there's innovative things like that happening. But there's so much more we can do to embrace smart cities and have that baked in into what we're doing in both Edmonton and in Calgary and in Alberta. There's a lot of opportunity there, and it's going to be a big emergent thing. A lot of it's simply just getting better data so that we can make evidence-based decisions. So not emotional decisions, but rather ones that are simply based on evidence. But you can't make evidence-based decisions if you don't have great data.
Now, much of this infrastructure is going to be reliant on things like 5G, or now we're talking 6G already in many different parts of the world. 5G has kind of been a controversial topic. A lot of people misunderstand it. How far do you think we are off of an actual 5G network and connectivity of things?
Oh, I think it's here. The only problem with 5G is that 5G is the type of wave it is, carries a lot more data on it, like orders of magnitude more than 4G or 3G. But the problem is the type of wave can't penetrate buildings very easily. And you need a lot more of them because of the type of wave that it is. So as opposed to having, you know, 3G would have had it could be in a radius of every five, you know, radius of 3 to 5 kilometers. Well, the trouble is 5G almost needs to be a radius of like 100 plus meters. So basically for autonomous vehicles, one of the things we're talking about is maybe every second light standard would basically effectively almost have a 5G modem on it that would allow car to car and car to infrastructure data sharing. So you basically need to start to attach them to light standards and put them in there that would allow for smart cities as it relates to mobility at least. But I think it's coming. The other trouble is, how do you make it work inside buildings right now? And that's part of the problem. It's you can put devices in buildings that can help that data transmission go further into the building. But that's one of the problems right now, the barriers for it.
No, change happens in an instant. Change is going to happen. And usually it's all of the prep time to ensure that change is good or bad or sticks. What should we be investing in right now, decision makers, policy makers, private industry? What should we be investing in right now, let's say Alberta again or Canada? What should we be investing in right now in order to make positive changes for our populations?
I think part of it is I think I'm a fan of having not politicians pick winners and losers, but really have experts pick it. So having, having a pool of money of X and having expert panels that kind of review different ideas that come forward and not doing it because it's going to drive jobs in this community or that community, but rather is what is the best ideas that can be best commercialized. The problem is there's no shortage of ideas out there, but there's a big gulf between these ideas and the commercialization of them and getting them to market and turning them into meaningful businesses that will thrive and take off. So what we really need is better access to, entrepreneurs need better access to capital, but the people that are pulling the levers on that, they have to be, if you will, technocrats, but technocrats that understand this space. And they understand how to commercialize ideas so that they're championing the ones that are the best commercial opportunities, not just simply a whimsical idea, but rather the ones that have the best market opportunity for commercialization. So I'm a fan of doing that, the government being in that space, especially places like Alberta that don't have, we've got a lot of oil and gas investors, but the trouble is just because maybe you're a billionaire or you've got millions of dollars to invest in the oil and gas sector, you know how to run a pro forma for oil and gas, so you know whether or not you can do an oil and gas performer and you know it makes sense or not. But the same person does not know how to do a performer on tech, and that's a problem. So their risk and liability is totally different, and they're not comfortable with the risk and liability simply because they don't know how to value it and run the performer on it. So you need people that know how to perform a tech and value it accordingly.
Yeah, I completely, that resonates with me 100%, especially when you were talking about baby boomers and the amount of wealth that they own. The Alberta region has largely been a region of investment into commercial real estate and oil and gas. And it's safe and secure, and it's what has made their fortune. Whereas, VC funds into tech and innovation has largely lagged in this region. We were chatting about Transpod earlier. Transpod has been looking for funds. Would something successful like Transpod raising funds there, seeing the impact on connecting two communities, do you think something like that would change people's mindsets in how they invest cash into different places?
Well, I think if it happens, I think it would be brilliant. To me, I think it's kind of, I think it's ridiculous Edmonton and Calgary competing against one another. We're really small minnows in the world. And we really have to be fighting it together and competing globally. And we can't, we can't afford to be parochial and have our elbows up with them. We have to instead be working collaboratively. We need to put their capital, our labor together. We tend to have a bigger tech market than they do in terms of the labor tech side, and where they have a little more access to capital. So we need to kind of put this together and create synergies between the two, because Edmonton and Calgary are competing against Chicago and Shanghai and against, Ho Chi Minh City and against New York and elsewhere. They're in a global environment, and with a globally competitive environment, they can't afford to just waste time competing with one another. They need to create synergies, and we have to have an attitude in Edmonton that what's good for Calgary is good for Edmonton and vice versa. For us to be economically successful globally, we have to do what's good for, just be happy that it's in Alberta and be driving things to Alberta, and knowing that, that'll naturally result in some synergies, and with time we'll create a 1+1=3 scenario.
I think that's just a fantastic idea. It's something that I think there's a real opportunity now with the new Invest Alberta Corporation to bring that together. It's something that we chat about daily at Edmonton Global and are beginning that process with Calgary Economic Development. You're absolutely right. Nobody in the world, from a guy who does FDI, you and me, nobody in the world knows where Edmonton is. And they hardly know where Alberta is. And so we have a real strategic advantage on working together for an Alberta pitch versus a city-specific pitch. So thank you for that. Simon, we could chat about this all day. Very interesting subject. You have such a wealth of information. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Sharing your insights. On that note, we want to recognize our presenting partners, FutureSight, the Government of Canada, the Government of Alberta, our supporting partners, InKind, Edmonton Chamber, McEwen University, NATE, as well as all of our participating organizations. All attendees will have a chance to provide their personal perspectives through a survey from FutureSight right away, which will be emailed to you. This survey will help government to hear your ideas and suggestions and ensure that we improve programs like this in the future and are able to fund programs like this in the future. Thank you so much, everyone, for your attendance, for your questions, for your interaction. I would probably end with, we're in the middle of COVID still. take care of yourself, be healthy, and if you can, take care of somebody else. Thank you.